The Health, Finance, and Policy Committee comes to order. We have the quorum. First thing to do here is approval of the minutes from March 17th, 2025. Representative Franson, would you be willing to approve the minutes, please?
Mr. Chair, so approved.
Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 17th are approved. Members, we have a full agenda today, so I'd like to ask members to be as efficient as you can with our time. We will be asking all testifiers to keep their remarks to 2 minutes or less. Staff will run a timer. Please quickly wrap up if you hear the alarm, please. First bill on the agenda today, our own Representative Keeler with House File 1878. House Files 1878 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Keeler, when you are ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. Today, I'm not going to take up much of your time. I'm going to send it to my testifiers because they do know best. This is for traditional healing through the Medicaid services system. The one thing I do want to highlight is that this is not a new idea. Other states have actually done this, Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Oregon. But actually, Utah was just the state that passed this, kind of noting that this is good policy across different areas. It's opening up the opportunity for our indigenous community to have access to traditional healing. As indigenous people, we believe in medicine in a different way at times. We believe in healing practices in a different way at times. And so what this does is it allows us to lean into what our traditional practices are, aligned with other practices for better outcomes within our health. With that, I'll hand it over to Dr. Rock.
Thank you.
Dr. Rock, please introduce yourself to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Patrick Rock, R-O-C-K. I'm a family physician at the Indian Health Board. I'm also the CEO of that particular organization. I've been there going on my 28th year now. I just want to thank Chair Bierman and Chair Backer for the invite to present today. And also, of course, thank you for the committee members for listening to our request. Today I'm representing the Indian Health Board, board's interest in seeking an 1115 waiver to allow for payment for traditional health care services. As Representative Keeler has mentioned, also it's not a new thing. It's been something that several states even in the last year have participated in requesting this. Indian Health Board is actually the oldest Title V urban Indian health program in the United States. So that particular movement started here in our state. And so now there are 41 urban Indian health programs across the United States. Part of the ITU system, or the Indian Health, Tribal, and Urban, or the ITU system of the Indian Health Service, we belong to about one of 41 across the United States. Unfortunately, we receive of the total IHS budget. The urban programs receive about 1% of the total IHS budget. That's the federal budget, and we have about 70% of the Native population lives in urban centers. So it doesn't run really well as far as cost is concerned. So. So we see this as a very valuable part of some of the services that we offer. We do offer those services now, but it's not reimbursed as a payable service. We see this as part of an important part of some of the extension of services we do. And it's something that's not new. DHS has long recognized the value of traditional health care services provided in settings such as ours. Back in 2012, there was a White Earth Needs Assessment done by Minnesota Department of Health that's still valid, and it shows that the urban Indian population here in the Twin Cities would like to see something that's an investment in traditional health care services. So.
Thank you, Dr. Rock. We'll have to have you wrap up the comments.
Thank you.
Next, Ms. Aniwash. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Hello, I'm Naomi Aniwash. I am the Indigenous Services Manager at the Indian Health Board.
So I'm just going to give a personal statement. So I had the privilege of growing up at Upper Sioux Reservation, embedded in my culture for the past almost, and for the past almost 4 years, I've had the pleasure of working in the urban Native community in Minneapolis and in St. Paul, aiding in cultural reconnection, something that has been systematically removed from Native peoples across the country. Today I'm here to shortly speak on my own experiences on traditional healing and culture as healthcare. I have firsthand experience utilizing my own culture as healthcare when it comes to my own mental and physical health. I leaned heavily on my own cultural practices to pull me out of my diagnosed depression and anxiety. Through my culture, I have been able to lower my stress and have been able to healthily and safely remove antidepressant medication from my daily routine. I was able to become more active through traditional dances, ceremonies, and farming practices that have helped me lose almost 90 pounds. And in turn, I have more mobility to be able to become more active, and it is something that I'm still working on to this day. I have watched the past 4 years through my work in this community, Native people of all ages become more culturally connected and have reported lower rates of stress, isolation, depression, and anxiety. I have seen Native people learn more about their traditional foods and incorporate them into their daily diet and reduce their symptoms of diabetes and hypertension. I have worked with elders concerned or living with Alzheimer's and dementia, doing winter count activities to aid them in memory loss, and the act of doing this activity has also helped them with their dexterity. I have worked with youth doing medicine wheel activities where they do a self-assessment to work on their mental, physical, spiritual, emotional, and or social health, and how each of these intersect and that balance is necessary to lead a healthy life. Their growth during our time together was astounding, and I've watched people achieve long-term and lifelong sobriety through cultural activities such as ceremonies, sacred sites tours, and other cultural activities. These are things that Native people have known about and practiced for generations. With the support of this bill, you will allow many Native people to feel empowered to take their health care into their own hands and strengthen an entire community for healthier generations today and to come. Gramya.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Aniwash. Any members of the public that wish to testify today? Please take the seat and state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Chair Schumacher, Bierman. My name is Kathy Gomez, and I'm here on behalf of the Birth Justice Collaborative to express our support for this important bill. We know that traditional healing services have been proven successful in improving health outcomes. Studies from the National Indian Health Board and National Council of Urban Indian Health demonstrate that incorporating traditional healthcare practices with the already institutional medical billing practices does improve health outcomes, especially in American Indian communities. Traditional healing practices take a holistic approach to addressing the physical, mental, and spiritual needs of their community, and this may often include, as we heard, sweat lodge ceremonies, traditional food intervention, talking circles, smudging, and substance use recovery programs. We would like to see traditional healing services expanded to other cultural communities across Minnesota as well, because we believe that this is a strategy that would allow for tribal organizations and the urban Indian organizations to offer health services and ceremonies that actually reflect the centuries of traditional health healing practices that have been proven to improve health outcomes, address disparities, and better serve the American Indian children and families here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no other public testifiers, we can move to discussion of the bill. And first up, we have Co-Chair Backer.
Thank you, Chair. First question I have two questions. And thank you for bringing this forward. What sort of outcomes, mental health, physical health, have you seen with the traditional healthcare practices?
So I believe there's quite a bit of knowledge on the actual, specifically in behavioral health and in chemical health in this particular area. So things like self-worth, reconnection to culture are kind of some of the two top things that pop into my brain, as well as just seeking other ways of, grounding a person into their culture to offset some of the issues. So anything else that you can think of?
Thank you, Dr. Rock.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
My next question is you know, and I think it was, I know one of the testifiers talked about that they see DHS, you know, quoting that the traditional health has similar outcome as conventional interventions and so forth. Has that been quantified? I'm a chemist by nature. It's going to become a doctor, change a different path. So is that quantified? Was there some scientific research? Do you know, because I believe you're the one that talked about it, how they came up with that, please?
Sure.
Dr. Rock.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. So one of the things that was mentioned earlier was a study done through the National Council of Urban and Health, and it was a meta-analysis specifically on several studies that shown actually a benefit without giving you quantified data, but it, in the end, it showed a positive or a net positive effect as far as improving health outcomes specifically around chemical or behavioral health.
Thank you, Dr. Rock.
No further question, Chair.
No further questions from Chair Backer. Anybody else with any comments on this one? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this, and thanks to your testifiers for the great work that you are doing for your community and that benefits all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. I would just also like to add that I appreciate the testimony of all three testifiers, and I think bringing cultural and traditional practices closer to members of the community where you see the health improvements as they happen, being that close to it. And I appreciated the time we were able to spend at the board this past fall and the learnings we had joining you and hearing from other members. So appreciate you, Dr. Rock and Dr. Eniwash, and Ms. Gomez's comments as well. You know, testifying that you're experiencing these health outcomes yourself in real time also adds to the data. So thank you for the bill, Representative Keeler. Thanks for bringing it forward and appreciate all your testimony. The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 1878 is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, Representative Elkins, House File 1652. Representative Elkins moves that House File 1652 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Elkins, you have the A1 to bring before the committee, and we would like to adopt that first.
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair.
So all in favor of the A1 to get the amendment into the shape, the bill into the shape the author prefers, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. To your bill, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the first of three bills that I have on the agenda that are somewhat related this afternoon. And I need to make a few kind of prefatory remarks here so that people understand the general process that's used to develop the formularies that are in health plans right now. So right at this time of the year, the health plans will be developing their preliminary plans to be filed with the Commerce Department for approval in the May, early June time frame. Over that period and over the summer, discussions will continue among the health plans, their pharmacy benefit manager partners, negotiating with the drug manufacturers related to the prices of the drugs, the amount of rebates to be offered. And the contracts among them always have a clause in them that basically locks in the prices of the drugs for the following plan year. So even though the manufacturers all raised their prices in January, as part of the deal that's negotiated among the plans, the PBMs, and the manufacturers over the summer, the PBMs and the plans have price protection built into those contracts, so those prices are locked in for the following year. So what this bill does is that it says that once the plan is locked in, the prospectus has been sent out to possible customers for consideration during the open enrollment period. Frequently, the patient who's choosing a plan, if they're on an expensive drug, they will choose their plan based on which plan provides me the best coverage for that drug that my doctor has prescribed for me. And they do so with the understanding and assumption, which turns out to be wrong, that if they've signed up for that plan for the year and the drug is covered, that it's going to be covered for the whole year. Except that right now, under the current regime, if a new drug comes on the market, for example, and that drug has a lower price or more likely a bigger rebate than the patient's current drug that's currently on the formulary, the plan can say, sorry, you can't take that drug that's been working for you anymore. We're substituting that for this new drug that may or may not work for you, and that's all that's going to be available. So what this bill says is that, sorry, like any other aspect of the health plan that you choose during open enrollment, the protections that are included in that plan when you chose it during open enrollment can't be reduced by the plan during the course of that plan year. The plan would have to change until the following plan year, where you've had an opportunity to go through open enrollment, consider your options again before they could take that drug off of the plan. So sometimes bills like this are characterized as formulary freeze bills. This is not a formulary freeze bill. There was a report by Milliman several years ago that says if the plans were completely locked down, couldn't make any changes at all to their formularies during the year, that could have as much as a 0.5% increase on premiums. This is not a formulary freeze bill. The plans would still be able to add, deduct, new drugs throughout the plan year without notice, except that if somebody's on a drug that's working for them that was on the formulary when they signed up, they get to keep taking that drug through the plan year. So the potential impact on premiums is de minimis once you take into account that the plans have in fact locked into their prices of all existing drugs at the beginning of the plan year, and that's baked into the end of the premiums. So I know we have a testifier.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Yes, we'll move to testifiers. First testifier is Dr. Laurel Reese. Please state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Dr. Laurel Reese. I'm a family physician on Ray Street, right here in St. Paul, right up the street, so taking care of patients right in this very neighborhood. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association in support of House File 1652, because when it boils down to it, healthcare is about people being healthy. And sometimes we get kind of lost in the weeds, but what we're here today, when we're talking about health, we're talking about health of people. So just to kind of reorient, that's what we're here for. For a lot of people, when you find a medication that works, you really want to stick with that medicine, and it's really important. It can be really difficult, time-consuming, take care teams to find that right medication, and it's especially true for people with certain chronic conditions. And once they find that effective treatment plan, they will often choose their health care plan so that they can continue the treatment that works. You found something that works. They want to continue it, so they'll pick their health insurance to continue that medication. But there's nothing in law that says that the insurance needs to continue the medication that they picked the plan for. And I really like the way that this is written, because it says if they're already on the medication, they can't make it not covered or increase the price. but it doesn't say for people who are starting a new medication that this applies to them, and it also doesn't say they can't offer a different drug for a lower price. It really just says if they ever, if that plan was available on their formulary when they started that plan, that they can't increase the price or make it not covered. And I think it's a real practical approach to this problem. What we don't want to do is delay care, interrupt care, get people inadequate care that doesn't work, because when it boils down to it, keeping people healthy is why we're here. And this helps keep people on the medicines that work for them so that they can buy a plan that works for them and stay on the treatment that they need.
Thank you, Dr. Reese.
Thank you.
Next testifier, Mr. Dan Andreessen. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Prescription drugs are life-changing and often life-saving. However, the cost of prescription drugs now exceeds the cost of inpatient hospitalization. Health plans are tasked with trying to manage these extremely high costs so enrollees have access to their needed medications. The challenge with House File 1652 is that it enacts new regulations on health plans when the root cause of the concerns is the enormous price of prescription drugs as set by drug manufacturers. Our nonprofit plans try to make as few changes as possible throughout the plan years because we want consistency for our formularies as well. While some exemptions in the bill do generally reflect current health plan practices, there are times when manufacturers do change their prices. As Representative Elkin said, there is some instability that we can kind of play around with in our premiums. But the way I kind of look at it is it's kind of like drug prices are kind of like severe weather. We know it's going to happen sometime during the year, but we don't know exactly what day that's going to happen and how severe it's going to be. We're getting better at forecasting it, but it's still a challenge. Now, I have spoken to my members, and it's rare that our plans make these type of changes in the fully insured market, which is the only commercial market that this requirement will fall onto. The self-insured market would not be subject to requirement, and we think that it's likely that many of the source concerns are coming from that market. We do appreciate the language added in the A1 amendment to ensure that all that this regulation applies equally to state public programs. The council has a standing position that these regulations on insurance should apply to all state regulated markets. Lastly, kind of Representative Elkins kind of alluded to, there was a bill last year that would have language in it that would freeze drug prices for a 12-month period. We would ask that at some point that language be added to ensure that prices would not change. If that was done, the council would be neutral on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Andreessen. Next up, Michelle Mack. And Joe Selwood will be following. Ms. Mack, please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Bierman and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, otherwise known as PCMA. PCMA is the National Trade Association representing America's Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs, which administer prescription drug plans for more than 289 million Americans with health coverage provided through employers, health insurance plans, labor unions, Medicaid, Medicare, federal employee health benefit programs, and other public programs. We appreciate the sponsors' numerous exceptions made to this bill, which we have discussed in various iterations across the last few years. However, at this time, PCMA is opposed to House File 1652. While there is an exception allowed if there is a change in the drug safety, there's not an exception for a drug shortage situation. We need to be able to change formularies when a drug is limited or on back order. In addition, the language does allow for generic or biosimilar drugs to be substituted for a brand product. However, as Mr. Andreessen indicated, it does not allow for changes that result in a lower net cost for the plan sponsor. PBMs and plan sponsors need to be able to make changes during the plan year to the formulary when pharmaceutical manufacturers increase their prices. And as was suggested, the alternative would be for an amendment to include that would require pharmaceutical manufacturers to freeze their prices for the calendar year. It is for these reasons that we would oppose House File 1652. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Joe Selwood. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Selwood, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, the leading trade association for the manufacturers of generic and biosimilar prescription drugs that save Minnesota and its patients $6.2 billion in 2023 alone. House File 1652 allows formulary changes when replacing a brand name drug with a biologic drug rated as interchangeable. This language does not include lower cost biosimilars. AAM is continuing to work with Representative Elkins, and we request that biosimilars be added to the exceptions for the following reasons. First, biologics now account for approximately 45% of drug spending. This disproportionate amount underscores the urgent need for affordable alternatives through biosimilar competition. According to MDH, drug spending is the fifth highest category within healthcare behind hospital care and physician services, and it's important to note that biosimilars and generics account for only 13% of that drug spend category. Second, the FDA has consistently affirmed that approved biosimilars meet the same rigorous standards as their reference biologics. The FDA recently issued draft guidance on interchangeability stating, healthcare professionals and patients can be confident in the safety and effectiveness of a biosimilar product, whether or not it has also been approved as an interchangeable biosimilar, just as they would be for the reference product. And lastly, over the next decade, 90% of biologics will lose patent protection. That will create unprecedented opportunities for biosimilar competition to drive prices downward. By adding biosimilars, Minnesota can position itself to fully benefit from these savings by ensuring our laws don't inadvertently create barriers to biosimilar adoption. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Spot on 2 minutes. Thank you. Next up, Elliot Boutet. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Members, my name is Elliot Boutai. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're testifying in support of House File 1652. It's hard to count the number of times that we have testified on the negative impact of a plan making changes to the drug formulary, benefits, provider network in the middle of the plan year. It's extremely disruptive to people's treatment. People with mental illnesses often find it takes several trials of different medications to find the ones that work. And once you find what works, you don't want to make changes. You fear if you have to change medications, and not on the recommendation of your prescriber, that symptoms will return, such as devastating depression, being overcome with anxiety, experiencing mania, or hearing voices. We're not talking about an inconvenience. We're talking about symptoms that can disrupt your life, your job, your education, your relationships. Thus, many people with mental illnesses who are choosing a health plan look to see if their provider's in-network and if their medication's in the formulary and what their copayment would be. They choose a health plan based on these factors. To have a health plan change the formulary or cost during the plan year is what I would call a bait and switch. People have chosen that plan because they can access medications they need and the providers they like. People pay to have the plan that meets their needs. Making changes in the middle of the plan year simply isn't right and causes great problems for people. It means they have to go back to their prescriber to find a different medication, which can take months to secure an appointment, or pay more for the medication, which isn't always possible. There's really no reason for a health plan to change the formulary mid-year. Hold them accountable for the plan they offered. We urge your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boutai, for your testimony. Any other public testifiers like to come forward now? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Elkins. I know you and I have had numerous discussions on this particular topic. I do have one question and then some comments. But the first question is online. Sorry, did I put it? line 1.19, it talks about the formulary changes, and it says specifically asks about removing a drug from the health plan's formulary in place of a, they may not, excuse me, I'm getting tongue-tied. So it says, except as a provider in this paragraph, the health plans must not, with respect to an enrollee who has previously been prescribed a drug during the plan year, remove a drug from a health plan's formulary or place a drug in a benefit category that increases the enrollee's cost for the duration of the plan year. And I just want to make sure that I'm reading that correctly, because I know sometimes it's not about the cost of the drug. Sometimes the switch is more about the having a drug that works for you. So I just want to make sure that it's not just, the trigger isn't just the cost. Does that make sense? Am I stating that question clearly? Sorry.
Line 119, roughly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just basically 118, 119 is basically saying you can't demote the drug from, say, tier 1 to tier 2, which would increase the out-of-pocket cost of the patient.
Good. Okay. Thank you for that. And then I just wanted to say, so, you know, what's one of the reasons that this has been a passion project for me for years, and I was so glad when Steve had taken this up, is that really what a lot of this says to me is it's sort of a good for me, but not good for thee, right? So it's okay for a healthcare company to say, drug manufacturers, we negotiate a price, we're going to lock in a contract, and you have to be accountable to that contract. But I don't have to be accountable to the contract that I set with my consumer. The rank and file folks who are going about living their daily lives, and the number one and number two reasons to pick a health plan are your doctor and your medication. That is literally the two things that everyone uses as a measure to decide what health plan they're going to choose. So to say that I'm going to lock you into a two-year contract and I'm going to make you honor the terms of your contract, consumer, average Joe, but I don't have to because I can change the rules at will, is fundamentally unfair. And I do not understand how we can have a contract in which you can literally change the terms and pull the rug out from someone under which you had set specific parameters by which you actually got that contract. That makes literally no sense. And I think that when we talk about this continuity of care, everybody's body chemistry is different. If you find a medication that works for you, more than likely you have tried and failed multiple medications. So swapping out your drug in the middle of a plan year for no apparent reason is just not reasonable, right? And it does have profound effects. If you are on a specific type of insulin and they put you on a different type of insulin and now you're exposed to higher blood sugars, ketones, to having your blood sugars go out of whack and you end up hospitalized. That is not a small thing. And so having the continuity of this bill to say, yes, you have to honor the terms of your contract. If I'm going to pay you every month and honor the terms from my perspective, the health plans need to honor their responsibilities too. So I want to say thank you for this bill. You know I am passionate about this topic. And I think it's just the right thing to do. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, well, hear, hear, Representative Bonner. That was fantastic. Thank you for that. And we've been down this road a lot. And I just have one small thing to add, and that is when I heard Ms. Mack, who represents the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, I think I heard her say something about how, you know, well, sometimes we need to raise the prices when the prices increase. And that just made me think, when people buy insurance, what are they fundamentally doing? They are shifting the risk. You are paying the insurance company to take the risk that something may happen. It is literally what you are paying for. And so what I hear her saying is, oh, well, we don't want to take the risk. It's still the consumer's risk. So as Representative Bonner said, that makes no sense at all. We have been hashing around this problem for a really long time, and there's always some reason that the industry comes up here and tells us, oh, that just doesn't work. Oh, that's not fair to us. Baloney. It's time to get this done. Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Representative Co-Chair Becker.
Okay. Thank you. My question deals with the practicality of how this actually works. So, and you may or may not know, and thank you, Chair, for, Representative Elkins, if this bill gets passed, because there is a cost, okay? You know, we hear a lot about, and I fully understand consumer costs. I'm in business. You want to always have the best possible prices and everything, but you still have to operate a business, okay? So will PBMs then just raise the price on a different formula to offset the high increase because they don't control, as a business owner, I don't control the market. Things happen and so forth. How does that all work out? Just want the operational of this happening.
Representative Elkins.
Yes. So go back to my opening comments. The PBMs and the plans negotiate the prices for next year with the drug manufacturers over the summer. They are locked down by early August so that the plans and the PBMs can make their final rate filings with the Commerce Department. And contrary to what Ms. Mack said, her individual members have all told me, yes, we have price protection. We are protected for any increases in existing drugs over the course of the following plan year. So there is no compensation to be made. The rate filings that the plans and PBMs made in August, finalized in August, reflect the prices they will be paying for existing drugs over the course of the following plan year. So they might benefit if new drugs come onto the market at a lower price. And, you know, for example, as Mr. Selwood said, there might be new generics, new biologics that come into the market at a lower price. The plans are free to add those lower price drugs onto their formularies. And patients who are taking the equivalent brand name drugs are free to try them out in order to save themselves money on their prescription costs, but they're not obligated to, and they might try a new biologic that's come into the market, find that it didn't work for them and want to go back to their current drug. But the key thing to understand here is that we're not really asking the plans to assume any additional risk that they did not calculate on when they made their final rate filings with Commerce in August. There's no risk.
Follow-up?
Follow-up. You talked about during your pricing protection plan, something like that. I may not have the words correctly, Representative Elkin. Can you elaborate on what type of pricing protection there is? Because they're talking about that the prices increased due to changes.
Yeah, I understand what you're asking, yeah. So there was a time.
Representative Elkins. Yeah,
sorry, Mr. Chair. There was a time when, and I wrote about this in the one the page email that I sent to everyone, but there was a time when the industry went through a cycle where when Congress first allowed rebates for the first time in 1990, for a number of years after that, we went through a cycle where PBM started taking on the role of negotiating prices, actually rebates, with the manufacturers, and they started out relatively small, and the PBMs were being rewarded on the basis of the amount of the savings, the amount of rebates that they won for their health plans. And so if it's say in year one, the initial rebate was 10%, the PBM would keep 1 or 2% and pass the rest onto the plan. But then in January, what happened is the manufacturers would all raise their prices so that net, they would still come out ahead. And this went on for a number of years. With every year, the list prices of the drugs went up, the rebates got bigger. until finally the plans caught on and said, wait a minute, time out, this isn't working for us, because every year the manufacturers were getting net increases, the PBMs were getting bigger rebates, but the plans and their members were not any better off. And so they demanded a change in the rules, and at that point, the new rules of the game were the PBMs pass all of the rebates on to the plans. The plans compensate the PBMs mostly on a transaction cost basis. And as part of the deal, the plans also demanded that from then on, the annual contracts that the PBMs made with the manufacturers said that we're exempt from the January surprise price increases. The prices we're negotiating with you in July and August are going to apply for the following plan year, and the PBMs and the plans, you're going to be exempt for those price increases over the course of the plan year. So again, there is like no risk that they're assuming right now. They protected themselves from mid-year planning or price increases.
Thank you, Mr. Elkins. We're going to have two more questions on this bill and then wrap it up. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I get Mr. Andreessen to come back up? I've got a question on how plans currently deal with changes to the formulary, and specifically to a person that may have an impact. How do plans currently deal with changes that are made to the formulary today?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doe, if a change happens, our plan reaches out to that individual no later than 30 days in advance to let them know that they would be a change in the format.
Representative Nadeau.
So my final question to Mr. Andreessen, and then I want to go to Representative Elkins. So how prevalent is this? I mean, is this a significant, I mean, as far as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, basically, 98% of the drugs out there are generics, biosimilars, 2% are brand name drugs. So how prevalent is this issue of formulary changes?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doe, I think in terms of formulary changes because of a price increase, it is rarer. Typically, you will see a formulary change when drugs come on and off, either they're new to the market or they lose their FDA approval. Those are the most likely changes. You probably could see the situation of formulary changes due to price happening in the self-insured market because employers are trying to move more costs to co-pays rather than premiums because they pay most of the premiums. And then Medicaid's kind of a different animal. So I think when it comes to changing a formulary due to prices in the full insured market, it's rare.
Representative Doe.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Andreessen. So how often, Representative Elkins, how often does the Commissioner of Human Services change the formulary in Minnesota?
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, the Commerce Commissioner doesn't change the formulary, but they receive an initial plan filings from the plans, usually in the May-June timeframe, but they can still make changes up until early August. And it's during that summer period between the two where most of the negotiations are occurring among the plans, the PBMs, and the prices, so that the final formulary isn't arrived at until early August. And then it's frozen for the next year.
Follow-up, Mr. Nadeau.
Yes. So there's no changes. So
no.
There's
well, you
no
can
changes.
Add. You can add things.
Representative Elkins.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Yeah.
There's no changes to the state's drug formulary from year to year. There's zero changes. So when there's an active fiscal note for this. So this is going to come back at zero cost.
Representative Elkins.
I don't know for sure if this will. There doesn't really affect. We could very well get a fiscal note from DHS. That I don't know yet. That's a distinct possibility.
Follow-up, Representative Nadeau, or are you good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I appreciate where this is trying to go. I'm just trying to figure out, and I don't agree with some of the, you know, some of my members on the other side that are saying that, you know, that changes don't happen. I mean, scopes change all the time. It doesn't matter if it's construction contracts, the price of gas. I mean, things change, and we either, you know, what this bill is trying to do is trying to tie the hands of one particular payer without tying the hands of one other supplier. And it's, I mean, if drug manufacturers are willing to freeze their prices, I have a feeling that, you know, some of our other partners will freeze prices. But I'm having a hard time getting my head around how this is going to actually reduce costs to consumers at the point of sale. So,
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, Chair, Representative Doe, I think that's a different bill. Hmm. This one isn't about the doing anything with the prices. And I have Mr. Chad Hope from DHS has appeared magically at the testifiers table to probably answer the DHS-related question.
Representative Elkins, we'll hear from Mr. Hope. Could you introduce yourself to the committee, please?
My name is Chad Hope. I'm the pharmacy director at DHS.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the DHS formulary, as you can call it, or the list of our preferred drug list, does change upwards of quarterly due to the changes in the federal Medicaid drug rebate.
Representative Doe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the answer is quarterly. So every quarter we change the formulary. Is that what I heard? Or?
Mr. Hope.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it can change quarterly. It's not typically a lot of drugs, but there are some drugs that change quarterly.
Final question.
Representative Nadal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with this bill, this would limit, this would freeze your formulary. Is it accurate for me to understand that this bill would freeze your ability to alter that formulary for a year?
Mr. Hope.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not necessarily for a year, still working through some of the language that was recently adopted. I believe it was through January 1st, so it could be upwards of a year, depending on when a member starts taking a drug or not. And I don't have a final definitive note on how often this could occur, but there could be impacts to changes to the preferred drug list based on this language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that we're laying this over to keep working on it.
Thank you very much. Representative DePell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the conversation. I just wanted to add that within basic economics, if you try to price fix, you get a shortage. If you get a shortage of something, then the price goes up. And as many members have brought up, there's an egg shortage. Eggs have skyrocketed in price, and that's due to bird flu. There are less chickens to lay eggs. We have less eggs. And as much as we would like to say that eggs should go back to $1 a dozen or $2 a dozen or whatever we paid before that happened, that just isn't reality. And it's the same with anything in economics. So fundamental economics shows that if we run into a shortage or we try to price fix, for instance, gas. We've tried this. Countries have tried this in the past. And if you do things of that nature, you end up with shortages. And certainly we don't want these drugs to run out. We wouldn't want drugs to run out. And we would want insurance companies to not have to increase whole premiums, or we wouldn't want to see insurance dropped over time either. So I saw here in Section 1 that it would prohibit a health plan from removing a drug on their formulary or placing a formulary drug in a more costly benefit category for an enrollee. Well, if the enrollee wanted to buy something like a stock option, which guarantees that you can purchase a price, that actually costs money too. So that's how that actually works in the market. You can pay more to have a guaranteed price in the future. But if you try to do otherwise, you end up distorting the market and you just end up with higher prices or shortages. That ends up being the cost.
Representative Elkins, short, quick response, or shall we?
Insurance is a product that we buy on an annual basis. The terms are agreed on during the open enrollment period at the beginning of the plan year. And so you're entering into a contract that settles the terms under which your care will be paid for the following year.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief, but I wanted to, first of all, Canada doesn't seem to be having the same difficulty with egg prices, and that has a lot to do with our agricultural system. But I will say, on the heels of the NAMI testifier, it's not just mental health. I have a dear friend with Crohn's, and she finally found a drug that would actually help her and went through this exact same scenario. And so perhaps it's 2% of the drugs, but it is literally life or death for some of those folks. And I appreciate being on the same side as Representative Elkins and AARP and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians and the Association of Clinical Oncology and the American Academy of Pediatrics, NAMI, and other folks who submitted letters. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Closing comments, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I think this is a problem that doesn't happen that frequently, but when it happens, as the doctors have testified, it can have severe consequences to an individual patient. And the cost to the plans and plan members of adopting this bill in this form are de minimis.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I renew the motion that House File 1652 be laid over as amended for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. We have an audible now, and we will be shifting from this file. We're going to move to House File 1075. As Representative Elkins prepares, I will also take a moment to reach out to Representative Keeler. I apologize for not asking you for your closing comments on your initial bill. And just want to note that rookie mistake by the rookie chair. So hope I can have some grace for that one. Representative Elkins moves that House File 1075 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Elkins, I understand you have the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like us to consider it.
Yes, I will move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of the author's A1, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
I just had a question on the A1, but it's fine.
Have a question? Okay. Well, we can address it in the. All right, Representative Elkins, two-year bill, House File 1075.
Thank you. So this is the first of a kind of a pair of bills that address the price of drugs to the patient. So I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions about this one as well. This is another one of my bills that has been knocking around for a couple of years now. In the interim, a few other states have actually passed it, probably most notably Arkansas in 2023. And that one is notable because Milliman did a follow-up study about that bill and its potential cost, and found that, again, the cost of adopting this kind of approach would be de minimis. So what this bill would do, it would say that, I should preface this one as well. So I talked a little bit about, how the drug negotiation process works. The other part about this that if you read the Wall Street Journal, that article that I cited. In fact, I think it probably, since a lot of members probably haven't, I gave you guys a lot of homework for this one. I should probably just read the beginning of this just to set the stage. So the way medicines are paid for in the U.S. has become so convoluted that some drug makers are setting two prices for the same drug, and many health plans are choosing to cover the more expensive version. The decision means that some patients are paying hundreds of dollars more in out-of-pocket costs to fill a prescription for an identical medicine made by the same company. Take the widely used insulin Humalog. Eli Lilly sells the drug for $274 a vial, as well as an identical but unbranded version for $25. Half as many Americans have insurance coverage for the less expensive product as for the higher priced brand, which accounts for 61% of the prescriptions. Kevin Favreau, who has type 1 diabetes, sometimes rations supplies of Humalog or used expired vials because the drug cost him so much under his health insurance plan. Earlier this year, he paid $630 out of pocket for a 100-day supply to meet his plan's deductible. "I think it's disgusting how much we have to pay for it," said Favreau, a 33-year-old lawyer in Irvine, California. After recently discovering he could pay less if he just bought the lower price duplicate himself through Amazon.com's online pharmacy, Favreau is now paying $105 for a 125-day supply of the vials. For years, doctors and patients have criticized drug makers for their high prices. The companies have responded in part by listing at least 10 drugs at a lower price. Yet some drug makers are also keeping the higher price that they had been charging. Others are introducing a new drug with two prices simultaneously, one high and one low. And many health plans are choosing the more expensive version, according to data analysis conducted for the Wall Street Journal. The reasons reflect why the drug payment system doesn't work like a functioning market. Health insurance plans that pay for many medicines often use middlemen called pharmacy benefit managers to negotiate how much the plans will pay. Usually, the PBMs ask for rebates from manufacturers in exchange for putting a drug on their list of covered medicines called the formulary. A higher-priced drug can result in a bigger rebate to the PBM. Drug makers say they have to keep offering the costlier versions to gain a favorable spot on the formulary because PBMs prefer the higher rebates and fees with the costlier drugs. Manufacturers say that their drugs' lower-priced twins do appeal to hospitals and health systems that pay for the drugs themselves. PBMs say that rebates can substantially lower the plan's final cost of drugs, and some plans use the rebate money to help keep a lid on premiums for all of their members. For patients like Favreau, whose health plans require deductible or coinsurance, the rebates offer little help because their plans often peg the out-of-pocket charges to the drug's price. I'll just leave that there. But the point is, we have this completely screwed up, broken marketplace where, because of the way the rebate system has evolved, the PBMs and the plans have this perverse incentive to choose high price, high rebate plans for their formularies instead of low price, low rebate drugs, which would give the patients themselves a lower price. They may be using those revenues to buy down the cost of their premiums, but we end up with a situation where it's the sick people who need the drugs who are subsidizing the premiums for the people who are healthy. And that's just not right.
Ready to move to testifiers.
Yeah. Well, so what this drug would do is require the PBMs and the plans to take the rebates and use the rebates to buy down the cost of the drugs at the retail pharmacy point of sale for the patient instead of keeping it to defray their premium costs.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. First testifier, again, Dan Andreessen, please. State your name and please proceed, Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Dan Andreessen with Minnesota Council Health Plans. The rebates that are collected by health plans are used to lower the health care costs for everyone. Just like we spread out the risk, we also spread out the benefits so that everyone is paying as little as possible. If we are required to apply rebates to the individual market or individual enrollees at the point of sale, this means that we won't be able to use these rebates to lower the premiums for everyone else in the fully insured market. This proposal will also affect consumer behavior. Drug manufacturers issue rebates mainly on brand and specialty drugs, not on generics. And as we'll probably be discussing in the next bill, these drugs have higher prices, and therefore a consumer may want to choose a brand name over a generic because they'll get a point-of-sale rebate. With the adoption of the A1 amendment, this now also adds an extra layer of complexity, especially at the individual market. So all the products that are offered on that market fall into one of four categories called metal levels, and those are all required by the ACA. Each one of those tiers are defined by a premium to cost sharing ratio. So on one end, you have platinum level products, which are premium, 90% premium to 10% cost sharing, and then all the way to the other side is a bronze level plan, which is 60% premium, 40% cost sharing. Now, this is kind of designed this way so that those who are buying insurance can kind of pick the ratio that works best for them. So, example, if you want to have a health plan that's lower on cost sharing, you might go with a gold or platinum plan. If you want a lower premium product, you go with a bronze plan. Now, even if you want a plan that has a $25 copay, you could probably still find that on a bronze level plan. Now, because of the differences between the metal tiers and the copay variety, the A1 amendment would mean that some products that are out there would have point of sale rebates and others would not. And so I think this is going to cause some confusion for consumers. So, for example, you may buy a gold plan thinking I'm going to get a lower cost sharing amount, when you may find out that bronze would have been better because point of sale rebates would have applied to there. So I think there needs to be some consideration for the A1 amendment language that was added. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Next up, Michelle Crimmins. Please state your name, affiliation, and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bierman and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Crimmins. I'm the registered lobbyist for Prime Therapeutics, a pharmacy benefit manager headquartered in Eagan, Minnesota. Our business model focuses on purpose beyond profits. We're not publicly traded or owned by a private equity firm. And as such, our primary motivation is not to maximize profits, it's to do the right thing. Prime opposes HF 1075 because it has the unintended consequence of raising the cost of health care. The bill tries to address the cost of health care by applying rebates to the consumer's out-of-pocket costs at the point of sale. This will lower the rebate amount that's used to offset the high cost of prescription drugs on premiums, moving costs that is borne by the consumer from a lower premium to a lower out-of-pocket cost does just that. It moves costs around, and it only lowers, potentially, costs for the consumer taking the drug and not the entire insured population, meaning a higher cost is borne by all insured members. For these reasons, Prime opposes this bill, and I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Michelle Mack. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Hello, Michelle Mack with the PCMA, otherwise known as the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association. I'm here to testify in opposition to 1075 because it will increase healthcare costs by requiring health plans to forfeit the savings achieved through rebates that have been negotiated with drug manufacturers and that help reduce premiums for all members instead provide point-of-sale rebates to a select group of health plan beneficiaries who are prescribed a limited number of brand name drugs. In year one alone, PCMA has estimated that this legislation would lead to almost $135 million in excess drug spending and over $1.6 billion over the next 10 years. It was noted that there were some studies from Arkansas that said that there was a de minimis effect of this. However, that law has only been in place for a year and a half, and we have to have at least 3 years to be able to tell if something does actually have an effect. It was also paid for by the pharmaceutical, the pharma manufacturers. I just want to let you know that the plan sponsors typically use the value of rebates to reduce cost to plan members or to enhance their benefits. Employers have the option on how to apply the estimated rebate amounts at the point of sale, but most of them do not. Plan members are very sensitive to premium costs, and point-of-sale rebates are correlated with higher premiums. Most rebated drugs already have lower cost sharing based on their being preferred drugs under a patient's coverage. And in addition, the Centers for Medicare and Medicare and Medicaid, or CMS, Office of the Actuary, found that if Medicare plans were required to apply rebates at the point of sale, manufacturers would offer lower rebates, raising the cost of drugs. And CMS estimated that point of sale rebates would cause a 15% decline in rebates. Rebates are the primary way that healthcare payers reduce the net cost of drugs for plan members. While not a perfect system, when there is competition available, rebates can save patients a significant amount of money. We do have questions about what market this segment would apply to, such as medical assistance, the Minnesota State Employee Group Insurance Plan, and self-insured plans. And finally, PCMA believes that House File 1075, by shifting rebate amounts to individual enrollees instead of applying them to the entire plan, will likely increase premiums for most enrollees. The bill does not address the underlying epidemic of high drug prices. And finally, it eliminates plan design choice for purchasers.
Thank you, Ms. Mack. Any other members in the public wishing to testify to this bill today? Seeing none, we can move to discussion of members to the bill. Representative Nadeau.
I get to be first this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question on the A1, and I was wondering if Mr. Harney might be willing to my understanding as I'm reading the A1 is that this would now exclude Minnesota Care, CGIP, it would exclude state programs. Is that fair to say that, or can you define that properly for me?
Mr. Harney.
Chair Bierman, Representative Nadeau, I think you're correct.
Okay.
That's fair.
Okay.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. So that answers the last testifier's question of where it applies. It applies to the 15% of the market, which is the fully insured commercial market. There was a cost, and thank you, Representative Elkins. I know that these are so hard, and I'm trying to understand, and I'm trying to get to exactly where you are with this. Is how do we actually get costs down and not raise premiums through the roof? And I can't see how this does it. And part of the reason is that I was looking back over, we eliminated the cost sharing for MA last year. And if there was enough money in the drug rebates where it could just be used and absorbed, you know, then DHS wouldn't have needed an appropriation. And they needed an appropriation of $9.2 million in 25-26. They needed $14 million in the next biennium. So there's a cost. And so if, in fact, we try to do this, and maybe this is a policy question. Maybe that's what it is. If we're just going to shift the cost of high-cost drugs, providing individuals a lower cost share, and we're going to raise premiums, then that's just a policy question we just need to have. And we just need to say, yep, we're just going to shift that cost. But is there anything there that I'm missing? There's not enough money in the rebates to absorb it. The plans are testifying. The manufacturers are testifying that. So if the plan is just to shift the cost onto premiums, then I think we just say it, you say that, and then we have that discussion. You know, 15% of our population is going to have increased premiums of, let's say, 20% or whatever it is. We can calculate it. Because we know there's a cost due to the appropriation that the agency asked for last year to eliminate cost sharing with medical assistance.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you. Great question. So I think with the respect to the elimination of Medicare medical cost sharing, basically you're eliminating the patient's copay on that program, and that the copay revenue disappears, and you have to have an offsetting revenue request. So I think that's different. I think it is fair to say that in this case, with respect to this bill, at least in theory, this ought to be a zero-sum game. There's a rebate pot out there of a certain size, and you can use that rebate pot to either reduce premiums or to buy down the cost of the drugs to the patients who are taking them. But there's also this second perverse thing going on where in a normal market, the plans would be, choosing the lowest priced drugs. Because of the perverse impact of the kickbacks, they're instead saying, no, I'm going to put the higher priced drug on my formulary to get the bigger rebate, and with indifference to the impact on the patients who actually need to take those drugs, many of which are life-saving. So you're trading off what's probably a very small increase in premium for a huge impact on the people who are taking these expensive drugs. As other testifiers have correctly observed, the vast majority of the prescriptions are for generics and are low cost. That part of the market functions really well. But for the drugs that are still on patent, where the drug manufacturer has complete freedom to set the prices under federal patent law, the only thing that is a check at all is the ability of the PBMs, quite frankly, to negotiate rebates versus formulary placement. We have very high drug prices, correspondingly very high rebates. It's estimated that the manufacturers are only netting half of their list price. As I said earlier on the previous bill, the plans are getting price protection against further increases on those drugs. But we've gotten to this completely perverse situation. We're faced with a choice by the plan, really. It's, the PBMs get all the blame, but it's really the plans that are driving this. The PBM's customers are the plans, and the plans are choosing higher priced drugs over lower priced drugs to get a bigger rebate, and then they're using that rebate revenue to buy down their premiums because they compete with each other mostly on premiums, and the people who are getting screwed, sorry for my French, are the patients who are taking the drugs. They're actually profiting on the backs of the people who need these drugs.
Brief follow-up, Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Representative Elkins. And I hope that our partners that are actually taking the risk and trying to provide and work with providers to provide that care, to find that balance between reimbursements for inpatient, outpatient, and drugs. I hope that they're a lot smarter than me and they're trying to balance where. The tools that they have at their disposal in order to find that proper balance between, cost sharing, provider payments, and premiums. I trust that that's what they're doing, I hope. I think there's, again, and thank you for bringing it. I'm glad that we're going to lay this over and try to keep working on this. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I just want to be very clear on this. I appreciate this bill, Representative Elkins, and I know how much time, effort, and work has been put into it, and to try to find a solution that's equitable. And I want to say that, I'm a realist. I understand that our healthcare system is completely convoluted. It is completely messed up. It makes no sense. Mr. Andreessen said that he's worried that this bill would cause confusion for the consumer. Have we looked at the current system? It cannot be any more confusing to the consumer. So I'm just going to be blunt about that. And we've created this weird, perverse sense of set of incentives. It's like when you go to Macy's and they say that they have a pan set that you could buy off sale any other time of the year for $50. But around Christmas time, they mark it up to $100, and then they tell you they're putting it on sale for $75 to make you think that you got a good deal when you actually paid $25 more than you would have any other time of the year. Except that it gets actually more perverse
and that in this scenario, the $25 savings isn't going to the consumer at all. It's actually going to a whole nother entity. And do you want to know what we would call this kind of rebate where we take, we raise up the price and we give a percentage of that to someone else in any other scenario? We'd call it a kickback. Let's be honest. That's what rebates are. They are a kickback. And we're saying that we're going to use this on the idea that we're going to bring down premiums. But you know what we also don't have? We have no proof. What the healthcare company is saying to us is trust us. We're going to use that money that we just got from this kickback, and we're going to lower your premiums. We don't have to show the math. We don't have to prove that we actually got that benefit for you by taking this money. And I have to be honest, in any other sense, we would call that criminal. So I find it rich when we say that we shouldn't make any attempt by folks to find a way to actually put money back in the pockets of actual consumers. And I want to remind everyone in this room, we don't work for health plans. We don't work for pharmacy benefit managers. We work for people.
Representative Elkins, closing yes. comments?
Thank you. In the materials that you've got, you now have time to look at them at your leisure, but there is the Milliman study on the implementation of the point-of-sale program in Arkansas. I should add also that the concept was actually pioneered by one of our PBMs, OptumRx, who actively promoted it to their plans for several years. And it never caught on because the plans told them, sorry, we'd rather have the rebates than to pass on this revenue to the patients taking the drugs. So all the PBMs can do this. It's seamless to the pharmacist and the patient. It just happens. And, the PBMs all know that that what's going on is wrong. They're trying to reform it. We're in this weird situation in this industry where the manufacturers blame the PBMs, the PBMs blame the manufacturers, everybody blames the plans. It's not any one of their faults. It's the whole system that's screwed up, and it's the way they interact with each other. And it's the market incentives, the misincentives that have evolved out of accidental public policy decisions made mostly at the federal labor level over 25 years or more. It's not a functioning market. So,
thank you, yeah. Representative Elkins, for the bill. I renew the motion that House File 1075 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Elkins. And now we are going to put you in the bullpen for a few minutes, and we're going to take up House File 1103.
Okay.
Our next bill is House File 1103 from Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager moves that the House File 1103 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. When you are settled, Representative Yeager, to your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Member, for the time today. I will do my best to be concise and succinct. I know time is of the essence. So this is kind of a continuation. If you were on the Health Committee last biennium, we talked about Roundtable RX, the statewide medication repository program. And this is kind of building on that work from last term. So Roundtable RX began in 2020 after U of M college pharmacy students worked to pass legislation to allow this program to exist. It's a nonprofit designated by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy to operate this medication repository program. Since its founding, the program has received more than $3.7 million worth of medication donations from individuals and healthcare facilities. These medications are inspected by a pharmacist for safety and redistributed to Minnesota residents who would otherwise go without vital medication due to financial barriers. It's provided nearly 600 Minnesotans with nearly 200,000 days worth of medication since opening. Think of that impact that has on your loved ones and your community. This bill is for ongoing funding for the operation and administration of the program. and some clarification to statutes, which my testifier will elaborate on. I would also like to refer to you to the handouts that were in there, kind of giving a better description and some nice visuals in there about the program itself. And joining me today, I have Dr. Rowan Mant as my testifier and Dr. Cody Weiberg here available for questions. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. We will start with Dr. Mann. Good to see you again. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today, Mr. Chairman. I am Dr. Rowan Mann, and I am representing Roundtable Rx, Minnesota's Medication Repository Program. Some of you may remember me from my days as a pharmacy student advocating for this program's creation. Today, I'm proud to say that Roundtable Rx is thriving, helping Minnesotans access life-saving medications. I'm here today to advocate for two key policy changes and continued funding to sustain this critical work. The first policy change would allow Roundtable Rx to purchase small quantities of medications when donations don't fully meet a patient's need, ensuring no one goes without a full course of treatment. For example, if a patient needs a 14-day supply of an antibiotic, but we only have 10 days worth, we can purchase the remaining 4 days to ensure proper treatment. I do want to make sure that I'm being very clear that donated medications will always be prioritized. The second policy change clarifies that local repositories, which are medical clinics or pharmacies that dispense Roundtable Rx medications to patients, can safely dispose of damaged or expired medications, improving efficiency and safety. Now to discuss the funding request. We are requesting $900,000 per year, and this additional funding will help us sustain operations, staff the pharmacy, and get medications to those who need them. State funding received in the last budget session fueled a 300% increase in medications redistributed. We were able to establish a dispensing pharmacy, and we are on track to launch a mail order services by May, ensuring accesses for all Minnesotans, including rural communities. This impact is real. An independent analysis estimated that Roundtable Rx has redistributed $1.8 million of medications to patients, with an estimated $2.8 million in total healthcare savings, so things like avoided hospitalizations, improved patient health, and the societal benefits like a workforce participation. But more importantly, it saves lives. One patient shared, and I quote, "Thanks to my care team and Roundtable Rx, I'm able to have meds I would have gone without. Thank you from a congestive heart patient who would have died without these pills," end quote. This program is cost-effective and a common-sense solution. Supporting it means expanding access to life-saving medications, reducing waste, and saving taxpayer dollars. I urge you to support this bill and invest in the health of Minnesotans. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Mann. Next testifier, Dr. Cody Weiber. Please introduce yourself and
Mr. Chair, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I am the former Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. I'm really only here to answer questions. Roundtable Rx asked me to do some work for them, mostly regulatory work in getting their dispensing pharmacy up and running and meeting all the statutes and rules. But since I drafted the original legislation a number of years ago, I drafted this language as well. So I'm here mainly just to answer questions about the drafting of the language, maybe the history, although Dr. Mann was really the driver back then, so she can do the history even better than I can.
Thank you, Dr. Weiberg, for being here and for all of your help in continuing to keep this operation going. Any other people in the audience that would wish to testify publicly? Seeing none, we'll go to discussion of the bill. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know who my question would be for, but I would just be curious how this repository would impact independent pharmacies. Would they be able to utilize this repository as well?
Dr. Mann.
Yes. So independent pharmacies, we actually partner with quite a few of them. We often work with local pharmacies, especially independent pharmacies, to help them with their patients that are having trouble to afford their meds. They're called our local repository partners. So we'll sign them up, and then they can use our meds for any of their patients that meet the requirements, of course, for this program.
Follow up, Representative Gilman.
That's good. Thanks.
Co-Chair Becker.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bierman. My question is, if you sit back and we look at this and you have this supply of drugs, would this not create a potential situation where pharmacies would then underpurchase what they need, knowing this as their safety network? And then what will happen is there may be less drugs when it's mostly needed. I mean, can you Am I not seeing something? But that's what it looks to me if I'm sitting back.
Dr. Mann.
Yep, thank you.
That's a great question. And I think for questions like that, I like to always look at other states. We are not the first state to do this. Iowa's been running for over 20 years now. And to just, this is a safety net program. We operate off donated medications. We are not always going to be able to fill everybody's request. And we work with our local repository partners. And as we become a mail order pharmacy, we'll work with the providers that end up having their prescription sent to us, knowing that we shouldn't be the end care goal. We are a stopgap. And while we are very effective at being a stopgap, and we've helped cancer patients, we're helping patients with congestive heart failure, we really are providing those life-saving medications. The goal is to get somebody on a better, more stabilized, not better, but a different program that's more stabilized, so that if they can get on Medicaid or Minnesota Care.
Thank you, Dr. Mann.
Quick follow-up.
Absolutely.
Your answer, I appreciate that, but then someone has to monitor that and judge, making sure moving to it and make sure there's not a shortage. How does that go about, or how have you seen it go about in other states?
Dr. Mann.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we work with a lot of safety net programs. So there are many programs that are trying to serve patients who can't afford their medications, and our local repositories are helping us identify those patients who can afford their medications through other safety net programs. So that's the big way that we're doing it. We also have pharmacists on staff whose job it is to make sure that we're providing care. We don't want to lose our inventory to individuals who don't need it. We are very protective, and we are really making sure that everybody who uses our program needs our program, but also we don't want to get bogged down in paperwork, because then other states have done that and have lost a lot of efficiency when you begin having a ton of paperwork involved. But does that help?
That's all I have due to time.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your work. And, you know, I've been involved in various ways with this for a while, and I think it's a great concept and idea, and it's been working very well. But my question is about the idea of buying drugs for when there aren't enough donations, which is kind of didn't know about that till today. And first of all, we just finished having a big conversation about the price of drugs. So my first question is, if you're going to buy some drugs from wholesalers, as the bill says, like, what price are you going to be able to buy them at? You clearly will not have the price negotiation power of a PBM, or exactly how is that going to work? And then, so that's kind of one piece. But I'm also wondering, here under the bill it says that you can may purchase the drugs from wholesaler to fill prescriptions when the repository does not have a sufficient supply. So does that mean if a person comes to you and they need a drug that you don't have any of, that you're going to then go out and buy that drug for them, or that you could do that? I just need to understand a little bit more how this buying the drugs piece is going to work.
Dr. Mann.
Yes, great question. So for that portion, the goal wouldn't be to supplement inventory we didn't have at all. We are trying to supplement inventory in those little stop gaps where, like the antibiotic example, if we have 10 days worth and we need those extra four. We don't want to just begin being a full operating pharmacy. But the reason we are asking to do this is Iowa, who we're most similarly based off of, has their pharmacy, and we just became a pharmacy as well. And they do that as well, and the goal really is to buy as few medications as possible. Just right now, we're not allowed to buy them at all if we decided that we wanted to try to make sure those tinier gaps are filled. But really, we just want to have the option, but the goal is to always use the medications that are donated.
Follow up, Representative Levy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And then the price issue?
The price issue. That is
Dr.
something
Mann.
That. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Go ahead, Dr. Mann.
That is something that we will definitely have to work through. I expect that we're going to try to partner with an organization that is purchasing drugs already and try to get their prices that way. We do a lot of partnerships with Roundtable RX, and I'm always trying to leverage other
businesses and organizations and the partnerships they already have. So we wouldn't be trying to do this by ourselves.
Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, to kind of conclude, I mean, so I think that probably needs to be clarified and worked out a little bit, because at the same time you're asking for to increase your budget. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little concerned that it could become, you know, so we give you an appropriation, you use it to go out and buy drugs for people who need them, but you're then buying them at this high price, and I get that you're trying to fill a gap. Another thing I just want to say for the benefit of the committee, I don't think you mentioned it, that there are really two big benefits to this program. One, of course, is to help folks who can't get drugs, but the other is to avoid perfectly good drugs going into the waste stream.
Yes.
So that's what really makes this unique, too, because, you know, somebody's in a nursing home, say they pass away, or they get a big supply of a drug, and then their doctor changes their prescription. For some reason, that's no longer. But the drugs themselves are perfectly good. And before we had this ability, those drugs mostly would just get thrown away, right? So they enter the waste stream, they're just wasted. So this is a really important program for that reason, as well as for the reason of helping people who need the medication. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Would you like to comment on that, Dr. Mann?
Yes, thank you so much for bringing up the recycling portion of this and being able to get those medications out of the waste stream, that it's a very meaningful part of Roundtable RX. For the budget, I just want to make sure to be clear. The majority of the budget is going towards staffing. I could send out the proposed budget and how it's all being distributed. Very little is supposed to be towards the part where we could purchase some of these inventory meds. Pharmacists are needed to run this program. Safety is our top priority in everything we do. And the majority of all of that funding is going to go to making sure that we have the staff, because we just keep getting more and more orders. We have so many organizations that want to donate to us that we're having to put some on pause because we don't have the staff to bring them in. So I just want to make sure to be clear that the budget is for the staffing, because while we want to continue growing the program, we wouldn't ever grow the program at the risk of patient safety. So we will have limits in place, depending on the budget, on how far we can grow just because of staffing. But we do also use volunteers, and we're trying to be as resourceful as possible. But having on-site staff that we are able to pay just really helps stabilize, if that's helpful.
Thank you, Dr. Mann. Closing comments, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, and thanks again, members, for your comments and questions. Thank you, Representative Liebling. You just teed up my closing comments for me, so thank you. I just want to kind of bring us back to kind of like what inspires me about this program. So it was inspired by pharmacy students. So they saw a need in the community, and they got together, and they have now brought this idea statewide. So I really think like the heart and the work and the patient safety is always top of mind, which I very much appreciate. I like the focus on donated drugs. It keeps drugs out of the waste stream. And I think it'd be a really risky business model in response to you, Chair Becker, when it comes to like relying on a program that relies on donated drugs. It just seems very risky to kind of rely on that as part of like the market stream. So from an efficiency standpoint, from a patient safety standpoint, you know, the fact that everything is very deeply inspected by pharmacists, it keeps drugs out of the waste streams. It allows someone who's donating those drugs that feeling that, like, I've been helped and now I can help other people too, I think is great for our community. It avoids downstream consequences of people going into the hospital, because if they can't get their drugs, and they get worse health outcomes, and then they end up in our hospitals increasing healthcare costs. So this is something I think for something so statewide, a lower cost that has a real impact on people and saves lives. And I look forward to hopefully earning your support as we lay this over.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager and Dr. Weiberg and Dr. Mann for coming in today. This bill is something I saw years ago. The first time I saw it when you were inventing it, I thought it was fabulous, and following the course of its development, we're nowhere near what other states are doing, and the opportunities in nursing homes and hospitals and everywhere else that may have drugs to contribute, as your closing was spot on in that, and so keep up the good work. This has also been a very bipartisan bill here at the House. So thank you for your work. I renew the motion that House File 1103 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you for the presentation. Next up, we are going to go to House File 2007, Representative Nadeau. Vice Chair Nadeau moves that House File 2007 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. I understand you have an A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like us to consider it. Representative Nadeau moves to A1. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion prevails. It is a correction. We're going to have to say that that was a DE1 amendment.
It was
rather
a
than an A1.
Correct.
So all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails. DE1 is so moved. The bill is in the shape you would like to see it in. Please proceed with your testimony, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 2007 begins to solve a growing issue in the healthcare industry. It creates a healthcare interpreter services work group tasked with providing recommendations to the legislature that support and improve access to critical interpreting services provided across the state. This work group will identify the challenges with spoken language interpreting, including requirements for registered and certified interpreters. It'll tackle access, barriers to access, reimbursement, training, and certification. Minnesota's healthcare interpreting community plays an important role in bridging language barriers between healthcare providers and patients. The need for interpretive services is increasing. It's especially challenging in rural areas, and accurate and effective communication between patients and healthcare providers is critical to the quality of care Minnesotans receive and the health outcomes they experience. At the same time, healthcare interpreting needs are changing. Addressing these needs and finding effective solutions requires collaboration and the expertise of the Minnesota healthcare interpreting profession. The goal of this bill is to increase access to quality interpretive services for patients, improve healthcare outcomes, and address healthcare interpreting workforce shortages. This bill was drafted over a long period of time with stakeholders, with input from interpreters, educators, state departments, health systems, health plans, professional associations, and with the adoption of the DE today, the input of the Senate as well. I have some testifiers here today who can speak to the need for this work group approach and answer any specific questions. And I would like to turn it over to Dr. Vang.
Dr. Vang, please state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 2007. My name is Dr. Tali Vang, and I serve as the Vice President of Health Equity at Hennepin Healthcare. As a clinical psychologist and health equity leader, I have seen firsthand how access to high-quality interpreter services directly impacts patient outcomes and helps address health disparities. Imagine being in a medical crisis, confused, afraid, and unable to understand your doctor. For many patients with limited English proficiency, this is their reality. Without professional interpreters, critical medical decisions can be compromised, leading to misdiagnosis, improper treatment, and avoidable harm. I recall working with a Hmong-speaking patient who had experienced PTSD symptoms due to sexual assault. She confided in me that she almost discontinued therapy after her first session with another psychologist, not because of the provider, but because of the interpreter. Although the interpreter spoke Hmong, they lacked the appropriate medical and cultural training to navigate sensitive topics with care. Instead, they used vulgar, abrasive, and shame-inducing language that made the patient feel deeply uncomfortable. For a Hmong survivor of trauma, seeking mental health support is already a monumental step due to stigma, cultural barriers, and fear. But when faced with an untrained interpreter who used inappropriate medical terminology, the experience became re-traumatizing. In another case, an elderly Spanish-speaking male patient showed up for a same-day clinic visit complaining of pain in his stomach that rose and fell. An untrained medical interpreter said the patient complained of a stomach ache that comes and goes. failing to convey that the pain radiated upwards, which could indicate a cardiac issue rather than a gastrointestinal problem. The physician initially diagnosed him with gastritis, delaying proper treatment for what was later confirmed to be a mild heart attack. A trained medical interpreter would know how to navigate cultural sensitivities and the significance of each descriptive word. The difference between an interpreter and medically trained interpreter is not just about language. It's about patient dignity, safety, and access to equitable care. This is why I am in support of HF 2007 or 2007 and urge you all to be as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Vang. And you have another testifier up at the table. If you could introduce yourself to the committee, please, and proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair Bierman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rosa Tok. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, one of the three ethnic councils for the state of Minnesota. The council is a non-partisan entity which is tasked to advise and inform the state legislature on the pressing issues facing Latino Minnesotans. We now account for 6.4% of the state, or 367,000 people living in every district in Minnesota, all of us contributing to making the state stronger. I am testifying in support of HF 2007. This issue is not only personal, but it also reflects the priorities of our communities. I am lucky enough to navigate the healthcare system, however imperfectly, because after all, who doesn't? Luckily, so far, I can access healthcare without the need for interpretation. But unfortunately, as Dr. Vang was indicating, not all the people our council represents have that same possibility. The healthcare language, as you all know, is complicated and difficult to understand. Except for medical providers and health insurers, this language can even be or feel foreign for native English speakers. So imagine how difficult going to the doctor or to a clinic can be for immigrants and refugees coming from as far as South Asia, Central Africa, the Middle East, or Latin America. For decades, our council has heard stories from providers or community members telling us about children or uncertified individuals interpreting for parents either at school or clinics. The need for professional and high-skilled interpreters will continue to be a necessity. We are very grateful that Representative Nadeau authored this bill, supports it, and understands the intersection between language access and reducing disparities and driving down the costs in the healthcare industry. Because of its nature and scope, this is a non-controversial, a common sense, and bipartisan bill. For almost a decade, the council has been a strong supporter of increasing access to quality interpreter services for patients in the form of assuring training and certification requirements for people choosing this profession, closing gaps in services in rural areas, and making interpreting training and education funding available. This will result in optimal communication, patient satisfaction, and provide incentives to reduce the shortages of qualified interpreters. This bill is extremely important. It considers establishing a working group with a variety of stakeholders with expertise in the field. And this group will help create a much needed space for the healthcare interpreting profession to collaborate on solutions, making sure that patients with limited English proficiency have access to trained professional interpreters. Let's make sure that this bill that is good for patients, for public health, and good for the bottom line becomes a reality. When people can communicate effectively with healthcare providers, health outcomes are stronger and come at a lower cost. Thank you very much for considering and voting in favor of this bill.
Gracias. Thank you, Ms. Tarr. Next testifier, if you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Aida de Oliva, and I serve as the Director of Language Services for Fairview Health Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2007 to establish a spoken language healthcare interpreter workgroup. Across our footprint of Fairview, close to 150 languages are spoken by our NELC patients, non-English language preference patients, and their families. And we provide language access for over 1,600 encounters a day that require language assistance. To meet this demand, we employ more than 55 full-time spoken language healthcare interpreters and many hundred more interpreters through our contracted partners. Every day we see the impact that accurate, meaningful, and effective communication has on patient outcomes that are experienced by our non-English language preference patients. This is even more critical when a language barrier exists and underscores the importance of healthcare interpreters to ensure the highest quality of care for our patients. One of the consistent challenges that we face in trying to meet the needs of our NELP patients is finding qualified healthcare interpreters for the many languages that our patients in Minnesota speak. Without standardized educational or training benchmarks, it is very difficult to assess qualifications which can create inconsistencies across our facilities. A clear pathway for education and training will also help to create opportunities for local career growth within ours and other organizations. This bill takes long overdue steps in starting to address these and other issues in partnership with our patients and our own communities. In bringing together our local interpreters, healthcare professionals, patients, families, and community partners, I am confident that we can work towards evidence-based recommendations to adopt educational standards for healthcare interpreters in Minnesota. This is an important first step in helping us meet the spoken language needs of our NELP patients and families so we can break down language barriers and improve the health outcomes of all of our Minnesotans. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for helping to champion this issue and to the committee for the opportunity to testify today in support of this important legislation. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Ms. Oliva. I think we have one more testifier, and we've been granted a few more minutes for this committee, so just 5 more minutes. But Andrew Morris, is he here to testify? If you could be brief. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Bierman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Morris, and I am the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2007. In the Council's 2024 Community Priority Survey, which received over 500 responses from across Minnesota's more than 40 distinct API communities, access to health care was the top priority issue identified by Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Today, there are over 365,000 Asian Pacific Minnesotans, of which many are considered limited English proficient. This is especially true in Greater Minnesota. This means many Asian Pacific Minnesotans face persistent barriers in accessing services, including health care. Peer-reviewed studies demonstrate that the usage of family members or other ad hoc interpreters results in statistically significant increase in medical errors when compared with even minimally trained interpreters. This is why access to quality interpreters is so important. The Council has previously championed legislation to improve standards of medical interpretation in Minnesota by implementing minimum standards for interpreters in basic terminology, standards of practice, and interpreter ethics, while providing interpreters with access to support and training to meet these improved standards. While this previous legislation was not adopted, we believe that House File 2007 provides an important opportunity today to consider needed changes to improve interpreter standards and patient understanding, reflecting changes in the medical landscape in recent years. Thank you again for your consideration of this bill, and we urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. We have one member who has signed up for comment, Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be real quick here. I just wanted to thank my former Hennepin County colleague for bringing this bill. I'm honored to be a co-author on it, and just wanted to say that I often dealt with and used interpreters in court, and they were critically important in that function. So they were also important in the medical realm, too. So thank you very much.
Vice Chair Nadeau, closing comments.
You know, thank you, members. This is a speedy track that we're on. The appointments for this will be done by August of 25. The task force or the work group will be expired by November of 2026. So we're really trying to get on this and get it solved and move forward. So I want to thank my testifiers and I want to thank members for hearing the bill.
I renew the motion House File 2007 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Vice Chair Nadeau. And members, we are adjourned.